Welcome to another episode of the Narrative for Social Justice podcast. My name is Caroline Gebauer and I'm your host for today. I'm a lecturer of English literature and culture at the University of Wuppertal in Germany and a postdoctoral researcher at Wuppertal Center for Narrative Research. Today's episode focuses on climate and environmental justice, as well as the role of narrative and narrative theory in the age of the Anthropocene. It's my great pleasure to welcome my guest, Erin James. It's so nice to have you here. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Erin is a professor of English at the University of Idaho. She's the author of The Story World Accord, Econarratology and Postcolonial Narratives, published with the University of Nebraska Press in 2015. And she is, together with Eric Morell, co-editor of Narrative and Environment, New Directions in Econarratology, published with the Ohio State University Press in 2020. Her new monograph, Narrative in the Anthropocene, will be published in April 2020, also with the Ohio State University Press. Erin is the co-founder of the Confluence Lab, an interdisciplinary center at the University of Idaho, which we will hopefully hear more about during our conversation. And she is the current president of the International Society for the Study of Narrative. Erin, would you like to tell us a little bit about your research and your current projects?
Sure. Yeah. I guess an easy way to sum up my research is that all of it thinks about the role that narrative or stories and storytelling might play in a response to environmental crisis. I'm very much aware that the environmental crisis is an ecological crisis, but perhaps even more so, it's a social and a cultural crisis, and that it has been produced by a particular set of ideas and a particular set of lifestyles. I like to think about how the stories that we tell affect the way that we live in the world, how new stories might influence or shift the way that we live in the world, and really how an examination of really popular stories might help us understand some of the behaviors that are driving the anthropogenic climate crisis. I also think a lot about science, scientific discourse, science communication, what role narratives can play in the communication of climatological science. But even more ambitiously than that, what role stories and storytelling can play in the generation of climate data and how we might find evidence for studying the climate crisis in the stories various people around the world. Another way of saying that is that some of my recent work is focused on this emerging genre of stories that some folks are calling cli-fi or climate change fiction. And because I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that term, which we can talk about, I'm sure, as we get going, I'm really pushing at boundaries and the borders of that term to think about not only how texts explicitly represent the climate crisis, but also how texts ask us, narratives ask us to inhabit certain worlds and how that imaginative work can determine or influence or shape the world that we live in. Yeah, I guess that's a really quick introduction to the kinds of questions that I like to ask.
Great. Thank you so much. Maybe because the podcast is called Narrative for Social Justice, maybe we can also focus a little bit on the key words in the title of the podcast. And maybe we can start with narrative. In the description of the work you're doing, you already talked about stories and the role of narrative. Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on how you define narrative. What does narrative mean? And what does narrative mean maybe in the age of the Anthropocene? And how is this connected?
Yeah, of course. The new book that's about to come out, as you said, is literally called Narrative in the Anthropocene. It's a really creative title. I tried to make it as explicit as I could. And in that book, I'm taking ideas that scholars and scientists and environmental humanities scholars associate with the Anthropocene and thinking through what they would look like if we rendered those things in narrative. It's partly a speculative project, which is to say evolutionary timescales are really important to our understanding of the Anthropocene. What does that look like if we represent evolutionary time in narrative? And indeed, can we find examples of this already? It's also, I think, a pretty clear expansion of our current understandings of narrative. It demands an expansion of the model of narrative theory. The narratological model is based on a pretty set group of texts, right? Which is largely Anglo-American and European novels written in the 18th and 19th century. And a lot of our key ideas about what a narrative is and what the particular building blocks or common building blocks of narrative come from these texts. These stories have embedded within them certain understandings of time and space and humans that are, I think, undergoing a pretty radical shift as we move into this moment of awareness of environmental crisis. And so I'm not only speculating what an Anthropocene narrative might look like, right, if we render some of these ideas in a narrative, but I'm also looking back and maybe critiquing is too strong a word, but expanding for sure our understanding of narrative. One of my key arguments in the book is that there are lots of examples of these types of stories, but we don't have the lexicon to talk about them yet because we're trapped by this narratological model that is based in these older texts. Beyond that, though, I think an understanding of narrative that is sensitive to the Anthropocene begins with recognizing a key commonality between these two things. And on the surface, they are very different, right? The Anthropocene is like geological, it's the world, it's, you know, really like lines in rocks, right? Geologic strata that we're reading to determine what comes after the Holocene. We're thinking about evolutionary epochs. And narrative is storytelling, it's imagination, right? It's kind of spinning tales or rendering information in a very particular way. But I see this very common idea at the core of both of them, which is the act of humans writing worlds. In narrative, we write worlds, we communicate worlds, we immerse ourselves in worlds when we interpret narrative or understand narrative. I understand narrative interpretation as a process of traveling to or inhabiting worlds that differ from the world in which you read. We can also understand the Anthropocene as humans literally writing the world, in that we, and I'm going to problematize this word we in a bit, I'm sure, when we start talking about the connections between environmental justice and social justice. So I just want to put a spoiler in here that I'm using this word very provocatively here. And I want to pick at it a bit later, but we, humanity, I should say some humans, right, have acted in such a way as to leave a semiotic marker of our activities and our agency in geologic strata, in ice cores, in tree rings and stuff. So when you begin with this idea that the Anthropocene and the narrative both involve the act of humans writing worlds, you can begin to appreciate the connections between them. That base connection has encouraged me to really emphasize the power of world building in narratives. I'm taking a lot of cues from previous cognitive narrative scholars that have come before me, like David Herman and Marie-Laure Ryan, but I'm kind of pushing that a little bit to think about not only are narratives tools of world building, but they're tools of world building for some purpose. They are rhetorical and cognitive devices by which we create a specific world and then inhabit that specific world. And I want to look at that, right? I want to think about the ethical stakes, the values, the behaviors that are implicit in these story worlds that we inhabit when we read or tell or watch or listen to narratives. And then I want to think about how that imaginative work of inhabiting a story world in turn influences the real world in which we live and in which some of us are in the act of literally rewriting. And how do those two things inform each other? So a kind of simple way of answering your question about what does narrative mean in the Anthropocene, I think the Anthropocene makes me much more aware of narratives as cognitive and rhetorical tools of world building for some purpose. There's stakes there when we inhabit these worlds, right? And those stakes kind of come to fruition in the real world in which we live.
So you said that narrative in the Anthropocene is also a way of rewriting, maybe also master narratives. Would that be fitting as well? Because what you just said made me think of current debates in eco-criticism that shift the focus from the concept of the human towards the non-human, or that have a look at this connection, right? I'm thinking of Timothy Morton's concept of the mesh, for example, or Jane Bennett's concept of vibrant matter. And you said that narrative is a rhetorical mode and a cognitive mode. And when you say rhetorical mode, I always feel like narrative seems to be something innately human, if one might say. How does this come? How can we set this in conversation with these eco-critic thoughts?
I'm so glad you asked this question. yeah, so this is something that I've thought about a lot. And another way of answering your question about narrative in the Anthropocene, again, we'll trouble this, right? But the Anthropocene literally means like the epoch of humans, right? Or the age of humans. We should maybe say the age of some humans, the age of middle class, you know, Western humans. My fundamental belief is that this climate crisis that we are experiencing right now is anthropogenic. It is driven by human activity. I absolutely agree that a turn towards the non-human or the more than human and sensitivity to other species and other materials and the agencies of those organisms and matter that we live with is really essential as a recalibration to better understand the world that we live in and the stakes that we live in, right? However, I also think that it's really important to examine ourselves. If this is a problem that's being driven by human activity, it makes sense to me that we would take a really hard look at humans. One of the reasons that I'm attracted to narrative is because I understand narrative to be also inherently anthropogenic. Yes, we can talk about representations of non-humans in narrative. We could even get into talking about types of material semiotics that have components of narrativity, such as recordings of sequences of events in tree rings or in ice cores or even geologic strata. But I understand narrative to be a cognitive and rhetorical tool that is primarily used by humans. And indeed, this is one thing that makes our species different from other species and other organisms. So narrative then becomes a very, very important piece of evidence for understanding how humans live in the world, understand the world. I don't know if this will translate into kind of German, but we have this expression in North America, that the cheese that stands alone. Do you know this expression in German? Does it make any sense to you? It's like the loner, like you're the weird person in the corner by yourself. And oftentimes at eco-critical conferences or environmental conferences, I find I'm like the cheese that stands alone. And then I'm like, yeah, but what about the humans when people are talking about material agency? And when I get really uncomfortable is when folks start talking about the narrative agency of matter and material, because that to me, it seems like an oxymoron, that I understand narrative agency to be particularly human, not to deny that other types of non-human organisms and species or matter doesn't have its own tools of representation, right? Or expressive capacity. But I don't know yet of another species or organism who can communicate in as rich a degree of narrativity as humans tend to, and can think in as rich a degree of narrativity as humans do. And so I get uncomfortable when folks start talking about the narrative agency of material, because I feel like that is an inherently anthropocentric move, right? You're taking a human way, mode of cognition and rhetoric, and mapping it onto another species or another type of matter. So I really want to tease those apart. And I want to position narrative as a cognitive and rhetorical tool of humans, right? That is, of course, influenced by these other types of agencies, but yet different at the same time. And because it's different, it is then a really rich mechanism for grappling with how humans think, how they inhabit their world, and how that might be different from other species and other matter. I also am the cheese that stands alone at environmental conferences sometimes, because I hear environmental humanities scholars really often making this argument about the positive power of storytelling and of narratives, right? That if we could only change the story, we could change the world, because we would encourage people to think differently about the world that they live in. And I agree, right? There's a real optimistic element to a different type of story. But I also think that narrative, to be pretty blunt about it, can be quite dangerous, right? And that it can encourage certain behaviors that are violent towards the world or damaging towards the world. Here, I'm taking a lot of cues from Suzanne Keen and her understanding of narrative empathy, right? And narrative empathy is being positive in that you can access different emotions, but also biased in that readers and listeners and viewers are much more likely to empathize with characters that they identify as being sharing an in-group. I also think about how we are more comfortable inhabiting worlds that are familiar, whether it's in the real world or imaginatively. And so reading, interpreting, listening, viewing narratives can foster some of these in-world affiliations where we read stories that help us make sense of the world in a particular way. And that makes it, that imaginative work makes it much more easy to create that world in the real world in which we're living. I'm taking cues here not from only from Suzanne Keane, but someone like Edward Said, the kind of formidable post-colonial scholar. He did a lot of work on, as you probably know, right, novels, right? Imperial novels. And he, you know, it was a little bit unfashionable at the time, right? Post-colonial studies, when he wrote Cultural Imperialism in the 90s, was really invested in looking at the new narratives of writers who had been living in formerly colonized nations and thinking about how they were offering up new worlds, basically, right? New ways of living. And Said said, yeah, but we also need to go back and look at the imperial novel as like a key mechanism of how that system worked. And we need to look at not only what is narrated in that text, but what is also implicit in those types of texts, in those types of stories, in the imaginative work that those types of stories demand that readers do, and how those types of stories can circulate very implicitly certain understandings of race and power and culture. I think there's a similar move that we could make as environmental humanities scholars, which is like, yes, let's study the really experimental narratives that are maybe helping us access, you know, non-human agency or material agency, or encouraging us to imagine non-human and material agency. But let's also look at the realist novel and think about the implicit assumptions and biases that are encoded in that, that encourage a certain behavior in the world, a certain understanding of the real world, and think about how that fuels this world that we have actively been writing over the past couple hundred years.
So many important and interesting aspects you just mentioned. I feel like we're already moving towards the keyword of social justice. So maybe if I try to disentangle that for a moment. So you talked about empathy and the negative aspects of empathy also, maybe, because you talked about Susan Keane's study, and the question of the study is, does reading fiction make you a better person, or what is the use of, or what is the function of narrative empathy? And that you mentioned the negative aspect of empathy made me think of Fritz Breithaupt's study and his work on the dark side of empathy, because you also mentioned climate change fiction or cli-fi fiction at the beginning. Maybe we can talk about this a little bit and then shift or move towards social justice.
Sure.
You said that it might be easier for readers to imagine worlds that they're familiar with, right? This relates to Mary Lorraine's principle of minimal departure that you also mentioned in your work very often. That's the basis, right? So how does this principle become important in climate change fiction? And maybe how can climate change fiction help us maybe understand the problems that lie at the heart of anthropogenic climate change? If we think of inhabiting worlds, fictional worlds, making sense of worlds while reading fiction.
So let me go back to Keane's work on empathy as a way of laying groundwork for thinking about climate change fiction. When Keane talks about narrative empathy, she's pushing against the empathy altruism hypothesis, right? And that's the assumption, the favorite idea of English professors, right? That like reading will make us better people because it will open us up to different experiences, and particularly allow us to try on different emotions. And therefore, we will be kinder to people who are different than us in real life, because we've practiced what it's like to be those people imaginatively when we're reading. Lots of people make this argument, right? I think like the clearest example I know of is Steven Pinker, who said once, like, you know, reading is making us a kinder species. And I'm not so sure. I'm not like Keane, right? I'm not quite persuaded by that. And I see, maybe because my background is in post-colonial studies, I'm very persuaded by Keane's arguments that empathy, narrative empathy, can actually be quite dangerous for a couple of reasons. So one, readers can have a false sense of the correctness of their empathy, so that they get it wrong, but there's no safety mechanism in the reading process to kind of alert them that they've gotten it wrong. So they might just misconstrue what it's like for someone from a different culture or race or gender or sexuality, et cetera, to have an experience or to experience the world. But then second, because of this in-group affiliation, right, you can end up empathizing with the quote unquote wrong character that you don't. I mean, the classic example is that you end up identifying with a slave owner instead of a slave. And therefore the slave narrative is not going to do the work imaginative work for you that maybe some scholars would assume it would. So I want to argue that the same arguments that we make about narrative and emotions as, you know, narratives as tools by which we try on the emotional experiences of others. And this, of course, I'm not only thinking about Keen here, but I'm thinking of Lisa Sunshine and, you know, her theory of mind work. I also want to say that narratives are tools by which we try on different worlds. And we're not only grappling with the emotional experiences of characters that inhabit that world, we're actually understanding on some imaginative emotional level what it's like to inhabit that world. So there are two directions that you can take this. One is the really positive one, which is that if you read a novel that is representing climate change, let's say a speculative future in which the climate has been altered to a degree much more legible than it is for many of us right now, and you experience the terror of that, or the sadness of that, or the anxiety of that world, you then maybe are much more likely to modify your behavior in the real world to prevent that future from happening, because you on some level have had access to what it was like to live in that future and you don't want it. So you're gonna do things to avoid it. On the other hand, if you are continually interpreting narratives that deny climate change, in that not that they actively say climate change isn't happening, but that they just don't address climate change at all, in that they communicate certain base assumptions that are being troubled by the Anthropocene, base assumptions like the stability of space, or base assumptions like human drama is really important and should be at the center of a story, right? And, you know, everything else is kind of background and context. If you're continually doing that type of imaginative work, you're flexing your muscles to inhabit a certain type of world that makes it much easier to recreate or seek out that world in non-narrative context, in the real world in which you read. Maybe because I tend to run inherently pessimistic myself, I'm like much more interested in that second effect of reading. There are lots of scholars who are looking at that first positive effect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. And I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. But I think this second project is a neglected project thus far. So a question might be, for example, what sort of assumptions does the typical realist novel ask you to make about the relationship between humans and the world? And how do those base assumptions link up with base assumptions that are also driving anthropogenic climate change? That's something I'm really interested in. But it's not cool to read Jane Austen as climate change fiction. It's not really something that people do, because we're thinking so far, I think many of us are thinking about climate change fiction as being very explicit representations of climate change, right? Mm-hmm. And doing this much more progressive work of throwing readers into these terrifying futures and making them have those experiences to kind of shock them into some sense of responsibility right now. But I want to do this other project too, which is what about like Marvel movies? Right? Like what about the types of stories that we consume all the time? Like how are they encouraging us to understand our relationship to the world itself, our place in it in pretty specific ways?
Yeah, so you mentioned the Marvel Universe. So I just recall that you wrote an article for Diegesis or Interdisciplinary E-Journal, and you present a very interesting and intriguing reading of the Marvel Universe. Yeah. where you show how the Marvel Universe perpetuates old narratives, right, or old narrative patterns that lie at the heart of the climate change crisis, one might say. You highlight or you point out these structures, yeah, of our human way of thinking that led to the climate crisis in the first place. Yes.
Yeah. That was a fun essay to write. Marvel, the MCU, the Marvel Cinematic Universe is like not my usual wheelhouse. So that was really fun. Yeah, I think, you know, in my mind, you can draw a pretty through line from Jane Austen to Avengers Infinity Wars. And I'm using Austen because this is who Saeed looks at, right? When he's thinking about culture and imperialism, one of his key texts is Mansfield Park. So I'm not singling out Austen as being particularly horrible, but just as a kind of example of a realist novel and illustrating or illuminating many of the assumptions, tropes of that mode. And then thinking about, I mean, Marvel movies are not realist novels, right? But they share certain ideas about the stability of the world, the centrality mm-hmm. of human drama, the longevity of humans, right? The mm-hmm. way that we can just like keep going and keep expanding, yeah. that I think you can trace all the way back to these older texts. And I'm interested in that backward looking project as a means of understanding how we got to this place that we're in right now.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I really appreciate your perspective that it's not just climate change fiction that deals with the Anthropocene, but basically it's every kind of narrative representations that deal with humans interacting with the environment, right?
At my most bombastic, when I'm teaching a climate change fiction class, to get the students excited, I would make a provocative argument like, it's impossible not to write climate change fiction in the Anthropocene, because you are either explicitly grappling with climate change or you are not addressing it. And therefore, yeah. you are implicitly calling attention to many of the ideas and behaviors that are driving climate change right now. Another way of saying this is I want to open up environmental humanities scholarship and readings of narrative in the Anthropocene to focus not only on explicit content, right, mm-hmm. but what is unnarrated in a text, what the author and the text will assume that readers will bring to the text, right, will download in their interpretation of the text, what's kind of hidden between the lines. It's a very similar move that Saeed does with Austin's Mansfield Park, where he says, this novel is not explicitly about the transatlantic slave trade and brutality of enslavement in the Caribbean, but that context, which is mentioned only fleetingly a few times in the fact that Sir Thomas Bertram's fortune comes from his plantation in Antigua, that context is essential to the explicit content that we see. I'm reading kind of between the lines of what is repressed by the text, right? Or what is kind of hidden or assumed by the text, to think about how even in that, in those types of narratives, you are engaging with certain structures and textual cues that are tasking you with inhabiting and building a very specific type of world.
And this idea of reading literature for understanding maybe social structures and seeing through structures and maybe also challenge structures, this might be a good point to move on to social justice, the next keyword for our podcast, or maybe in our context or in our conversation today, climate justice. You mentioned Saeed and your first book, The Story World Accord. It's about inhabiting fictional worlds, but you combine eco-criticism with post-colonial theory. And you already referred to this approach in your previous answers to my questions. So maybe you can say a little bit about what does climate justice mean for you, and how is it connected to social justice? What are the similarities? What are the differences? And maybe then again, as a next step, how can we connect that to narrative?
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, I think I would begin answering that question by emphatically saying that climate justice is social justice. You cannot tease out the two. A key claim of environmental humanities scholarship is that it's not enough to study climate change without thinking about human culture and human society, and in particular, human inequity. You can't understand one without grappling with the other. I was just yesterday giving a guest lecture to an environmental science class at the University of Idaho, where I was talking about this, right? It's like, you can't understand the threats to an ecosystem without also thinking about human behaviors, right? And what are causing those threats, and how those behaviors are driven by inequity and injustice, and et cetera, et cetera. In my first book, The Story World Accord, I was writing that in the wake of the failure of the Kyoto Protocol, right? And the absolute dismal, like the kind of early days of really dismal attempts to come up with some sort of international transcultural environmental policy. I thought I was writing in a pretty pessimistic moment. Looking back on that now, it seems like so much more optimistic than the moment that we're in, right? Where there was still maybe even hope that some sort of big international transcultural environmental policy could come about. In that book, which is really centering Caribbean and African writing, I'm thinking about how the act of telling and interpreting stories can facilitate those big international transcultural environmental conversations. I was aware that one of the reasons protocols like Kyoto fail is because of politics, particularly power dynamics between developing and developed countries and all the stuff that we think about when we think about the trickiness of talking about climate change on a global scale. But I was also interested in the idea, in the kind of more subtle problem, which is that we don't realize sometimes when we talk to people from different cultural backgrounds or different experiences, that we talk at cross purposes when we talk about the environment. We tend to talk about the environment as like one thing, right? Like it's like a word that we use and we assume that everyone understands the same way, or even subcategories of that, like forest or coast or wetlands. But these things are culturally coded in many, many different ways. And they carry within them a lot of site-specific history and stories. And so I was wondering how the act of telling stories and interpreting stories and doing that mental and imaginative work and emotional work of inhabiting a particular ecosystem or environment from the perspective of someone who is not from your same culture background or doesn't share many of the markers of your identity, how that might facilitate, if not empathy, at least some sort of awareness and understanding that we all perceive and live in the world in very different ways. In the newer book, In Narrative in the Anthropocene, I think I'm really continuing that project, but I'm interested in the ways that stories and narratives can help us recognize a lot of the injustices and divisions and inequities that get patched over in a concept like Anthropocene, or in a phrase like human-caused climate change or anthropogenic climate change. There are lots of scholars who've done really great work in this. Rob Nixon is so smart about thinking about inequity, climate justice. Stephanie Lemonager has written really persuasively about this. But in one of the chapters in this book, I really call attention to the problems with a term like Anthropocene and some of the arguments that that term has produced. Like, for example, historian Deepresh Chakrabarty in his writing on species thinking and his idea that historians not only need to be aware of traditional ways of understanding human culture, which is divisions within kind of human societies and across human societies, but also be aware of humanity on the species level and the kind of collective agency of the species human. And of course, that's really both useful in a geologic sense. Right? We go back to that idea of humans registering themselves in the strata. But it should make us really uncomfortable, I think, because it allows us to inhabit an illusion that we are all in this together and we are all causing this together. And that is fundamentally not true. Mm-hmm. Some of us are causing this more than others. And some of us are inhabiting this more than others at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I want to think about how specific narrative structures can help us imagine some of this inequity, some of these issues of social justice, and then also, you know, develop the kind of cognitive tools, emotional tools for appreciating how different people live in the world, how that might be different from us. The idea that we are not humans, right? It's a kind of concept that exists in geologic strata, maybe only. You know, we as humans is a really it's a really damaging illusion. So yeah, long-winded way of saying that I still have this optimistic understanding that reading across cultural lines or across identity lines can give you access and perhaps facilitate understanding of injustice and inequity. But that comes with a hesitation of everything that we were talking about earlier about the world-building power of narratives as often confirming, right, or doubling down on your own biases and your own understanding of the world that you live in.
I really like what you said about this idea of collective agency. And for our talk today, I reread an interview that you gave to Birgit Spengler, and there you also talked about this idea of collective agency. And it made me think about the difference between collective agency and individual agency in the age of the Anthropocene, because you already mentioned that there are so many power structures involved when we talk about the Anthropocene, and it's on so many levels, right? You said climate justice is basically social justice because all these different power structures are involved here. Not only to the extent that some of us are contributing much more to the problem than others, but also that some of us are trying maybe to fight against climate change, right? Or maybe to raise awareness of climate change and try to problematize what's actually happening in the world right now. I'm thinking of young activists at the moment. So in Europe, we have Fridays for Future, that's what made me think about collective agency and individual agency. So if we think of generational differences in industrialized parts of the world, at least we have contributed very, very much to climate change. And now that we have the young teenagers going out on the streets every Friday and protesting and demonstrating and trying to make politicians change something, right? Not only raising awareness, but they are actually demanding action from politicians. And that also made me think about this idea of agency, because we have collective agency. So the human species has collective agency. But if we think of climate change from an individual perspective, I also feel that these days, a lot of people just feel that they lack agency. Mm-hmm. Because this idea of if I do something and if I try to change it, okay, but it's not enough because we all have to do it together in order to change something.
Yeah, Fridays for Future, I mean, the analogous organization in America that comes to mind is a Sunrise Movement, like the kind of generational, younger generation leading climate change initiatives and demanding action. This is recalling one of the books that I look at in the new book. Do you know Lydia Millett's A Children's Bible? Have you read this novel? Mm-hmm. It's really great. It's one of my favorite examples of cli-fi. It came out a couple years ago, and it's about a group of families who go on holiday together. They rent a big house and they go on the holiday, and the children all hang out together and the parents all hang out together. The children are mainly teenagers. And there's a giant storm that comes through, a major, major weather event comes through, destroys the house, separates the children and the parents, is basically a point of no return in terms of climate apocalypse in this fictional world. One of the reasons that I really like this book is because it's very angry. It's written from the perspective of the children. Our narrator is a young girl named Evie, and she and her peers are just viciously angry at the parents for being totally useless, like basically so lethargic to be dead effectively. And at one point, the kids all kind of gang up on the parents and say, like, you did this. And like, you're a liar. Like, you have not done enough. And I really appreciate that book for it's the text I know of that best captures that generational divide and that fury of younger generations. But another reason I really appreciate this book is because of some of the tricky stuff it does in terms of narration and agency. It is a text that is narrated in the first person by this young girl, Evie. So we can say it's autodiegetic narration, right? That the protagonist is the narrator. But it also involves a lot of passages of collective action, collective identity. Indeed, like we don't know the name of Evie until maybe 14 pages into the novel. And the first couple pages are all statements like, we ran, we swam, we threw rocks, we did this, we did this, we did this. The narrative really asks you to toggle back and forth between this collective identity and the individual identity of Evie. You often, in the passages that are explaining the collective group, their actions. We don't have a lot of information about what it's like to experience emotions as a collective group, right? We just know that they are like running and swimming and doing stuff. All the emotional content comes from Evie, but the text is calling attention to this dynamic, right, of collective actions and individual emotional experiences. That's the kind of thing that I'm interested in pushing on, is like, how can a text encourage you to toggle back and forth between an awareness of collective action and individual human agency, and indeed like individual discomfort with the collective, right? Like knowing that you are a part of a collective, but maybe not be happy about it, right? How do we talk about that? Like, what is the narrative structure? Like, what do we call that style of narration? What sort of imaginative work does that text ask us to do? And how might we harness some of that imaginative work when we're talking about these really difficult topics, like the difference between collective action and kind of individual agency, or the possibility of collective agency, or what it's like to be part of a collective? So yeah, that's the type of reading that I do in this book, right? Is to take these big debates and ideas about the Anthropocene, think about what they might look like in a narrative, try to find an example of that, and then do a kind of really detailed close reading of that story to try to illuminate some of the imaginative and cognitive demands that it's making on readers, right? And what sorts of world-building muscles it's asking them to flex as they interpret the text.
Yeah, and it seems like really some kind of exercise because, right, the idea of being part of a collective, but then you're part of the collective, but somehow you try to distance yourself from the collective in this narrative.
What's fascinating about this novel too is that there's different collectives, right? There's the collective of the children, and they all have names. They are individual characters, but they often act together. And then there's the collective of the parents who are unnamed, they're undifferentiated. They're just like this mass of drunken people who are just kind of shopping on Amazon Prime and like not paying attention to the world, right? And so it's also helpful, that text, in showing that even if you are part of a collective, by definition, there is a group that is, you know, a we always needs a them to define themselves against. Yeah. So that's also very interesting and very helpful. And I think about the dynamic between those two groups, right? And the two representations of collective agency, one being a little bit more sensitive than the other.
This also made me think of another aspect, because I'm doing a lot of research on mobility and migration right now. And I mean, if we think of the Anthropocene and your idea that we should not give up the human as a concept in this debate, then, of course, if we think of questions of social justice, then it's also about people who are forced to leave their homes because of climate disasters. So another aspect. So there are so many problems on so many levels that are connected to climate change.
Yeah, very much so. Climate refugeeism is, you know, it's huge, and I don't think it's a coincidence that a lot of the earlier climate change fiction novels, like something like Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower, there are a lot of road trips in those novels, right? As people are hitting the road to escape. And that's a clear trope that runs right through the genre from the very beginning, this idea of displacement.
We talked a lot about the definition of narrative and the relation to the Anthropocene and the question of social justice and climate justice. Another question I might be interested in is, how do you, as a literary scholar and a narrative theorist, how do you teach narratives of the Anthropocene? How do you make your students reflect upon questions relating to climate change, climate justice, the Anthropocene, all these aspects?
So I, along with my colleague, Jen Ladino at the University of Idaho, we kind of oscillate teaching a course on climate change fiction each year. And the course is an English course, but it's open to anyone on campus. And we tend to get students from the environmental science program at our school, plus other places as well. And my approach to teaching climate change fiction is explicitly narratological. I begin the semester basically giving a series of lectures on narrative worlds, story worlds, narrative chronology and temporality, narrative spatialization, narration, and then different types of semiotic representation, whether it's narrative as a kind of human rhetorical cognitive mode or different types of material agency and non-human agency, and representations of material and non-human experiences. And so I do like a crash course in narrative terminology. And I really feel that this helps students understand how these texts are put together, and therefore allows them to appreciate exactly what we've been talking about, is like, for what purpose is this text asking you to build a world and inhabit a world? It also, I think, helps take some of the despair out of the class, because these books are, a lot of them are pretty depressing and alarming. There's some that are funny, but a lot of them are worrisome, and they produce anxiety. And so I think when we get in and begin to appreciate how the cogs are turning, it makes the emotions of the class a little bit more manageable. I also like in that class to ask questions about genre and mode and about different types of media and the affordances of different types of text. Like, what can you do in a short story that you can't do in a novel, and vice versa? What can you do in a graphic novel or a cinematic text that you can't do? What can you do in an oral story that you can't do in a written text? So I like to assign a really, really wide range of texts, everything from big 600-page novels to flash fiction, to graphic novels, to television commercials and short stories, to music. And we think about how each type of narrative comes with its own possibilities and constraints. I have an essay about this coming out in a book I think it should be out this summer. It's Cambridge Critical Concepts on Nature, that's edited by Scott Slovic and Peter Remian. And I have an essay, basically a pedagogical essay, talking about some of the things that I do in my class. So yeah, if people want to check that out.
So that's also my experience, that when you make students understand narratological terminology, then it's for them, it somehow is easier to see through the structures. The example that you mentioned in the beginning, the Avenger universe, if you can analyze how these films on what kind of master narratives they rely on and how they influence the viewer, then it's sometimes also a good way to challenge these structures. And I feel like a narratological lens very often helps us to see through the structures and read between the lines and find these differences.
Exactly. It can also, you know, if you're teaching an interdisciplinary class, most of the students who sign up for a class like that are interested in climate change. But occasionally, you will get a student who's more resistant to certain ideas than others. But focusing on form is a way of creating an accessible place to talk about the text that doesn't escape a lot of the ideological debates, right? But at least gives us an anchor point by which we can talk about something rather than talking at a much higher level that really doesn't have anything to do with the text itself, right? But is kind of bigger debates that are circulating. So I find that super helpful, that real nitty-gritty narratological close reading analysis. Really, really helpful in a class like climate change fiction. Also in classes in which I'm teaching other controversial subjects like race or gender or sexuality, giving people a very, very clear textual cue that we want to analyze can be a way of creating a safer place to talk about some of these issues.
We are approaching the end, but maybe one question about your work in the Confluence Lab, because I know from other contexts that you also deal with the climate crisis in non-fictional contexts, you might say, right? And this is what you're doing in the Confluence Lab. Maybe you would like to tell us a little bit about your work in this context.
The Confluence Lab, I started this about 4 years ago with two colleagues. So my colleague, Jen Ladino, who is in the English department, who is a specialist in Western American literature, but also affect theory. She's really, really smart on affect theory. She also was a park ranger for like 13 years. She's a really cool person. And then our colleague, Teresa Cohen, who was in the College of Natural Resources at the University of Idaho. She's recently taken a position, a similar position at the University of New Hampshire. So it's two humanities scholars and a scientist, right? Teresa is a geographer. She's also a specialist in science communication. And we really came together. It started over coffee, you know, just the three of us talking and expressing some frustration about the ideological, political, cultural divides in our state in particular. You know, Idaho is a very Republican state, right? It votes, it's very conservative, it tends to vote Republican. It's incredibly rural, and it has some pretty significant environmental issues that are getting worse, but they are very, very hard to talk about because of the ideological and cultural divides that are kind of built into some of these issues. We are also inspired by some of our colleagues in the science departments on our campus who said basically, like, I can't gather the data that I need because I can't speak to people in rural communities in a way that's productive, right? Like, I need help. And so we started thinking, okay, well, what would it be like? What would an experiment or a study be like that is looking at environmental crisis in our region, but is building in from the ground level tools of the arts and the humanities? So storytelling, emotions, representation. And we began to really conceive of how the humanities and the arts and the sciences might work together and bristle against this typical relationship that happens in which the scientists do the science and then they ask the artists and the humanities scholars to help package the science for consumption. So, like, can you proofread this? Can you tell me how to say this? Can you make a really lovely pie chart so that my findings are clear? And we said, like, no, we're not doing that. We're instead going to collect data via stories, and we're going to think of stories as a form of data, and we're going to see what we can learn about these environmental issues by doing this type of work. So one clear example of this is a project that we're just wrapping up. It was a two-year grant that was funded by the National Science Foundation that was looking at wildfire in our region, so Idaho, Eastern Washington. One of the reasons we chose wildfire is because it's quote unquote kind of safer conceptual terrain than climate change, right? Climate change, like, you say the words and you kick off a whole bunch of assumptions and debates, but wildfire, everyone has an experience of wildfire, right? And so we can kind of talk about wildfire in a way that doesn't come with so much baggage, right? Mm. So we, with the help of, you know, put together a team and with the help of some amazing graduate students, collected 40 stories of what we call frontliners. So these are people who've been evacuated or lost property because of fire, people who fight fire, smoke jumpers, fire professionals. And we talked to them and we collected their stories of fire. And we've spent the last couple of years analyzing those stories to learn what we can from them, right? And we're learning on both sides of the coin. So we're thinking about this sort of fire science and fire ecology that is in those stories, how the findings that we are looking at there can help us better understand fire ecology and fire science, or maybe even some of the messages of fire science and fire ecology that are not in circulation yet. But then also thinking about, you know, the building blocks and narrative structures of these stories. How do people tend to talk about fire? And what type of world do these stories immerse you in as a listener? How does that challenge not only our understanding of what it's like to experience fire, but maybe even our understanding of how narrative works, right? How can we think through this? And so we've got like a range of publications coming out now. Everything from the role of nostalgia in the development of fire regimes, right, by fire ecologists, to how these stories really challenge assumptions about narrative empathy and the kind of role that narratives can play in communicating shareable emotions. So that's been a really, really great project. That's one example of the type of Confluence Lab stuff that we do. We like to think of ourselves as a bit of an incubating force. So we're also like matchmakers. We will match people, you know, humanities and artists and kind of science scholars who are working together and help them develop projects. Another project that we're working on right now is on climate skepticism. This is a project that's dipping its toes into imperial eco-criticism, which is the kind of study of the real world effects of environmental stories on readers, right? So what type of media has helped former climate skeptics change their mind about climate change? How are those stories or narratives put together? How do they differ from other narratives that tend to circulate? That's another project that we're working on right now.
Great. That's interesting, fascinating, and very important. I think this nicely complements what you said at the beginning of the interview, this idea that narrative is a cognitive mode that helps us understand our world. These stories that people told you help us understand how we perceive or how we make sense of the Anthropocene, but it's also a way of performing, right? It's also, again, this rhetorical act.
Very much so. Yeah.
So, unfortunately, our time is up. But
it's been so fun.
Yes, thank you so much for this invigorating conversation, Erin. It's been wonderful to have you here.
I'm so pleased to have been here. This has been really fun. Thank you so much.
I can't wait to read your book, and I'm sure that a lot of our listeners have become curious as well now. Now we're all waiting for your book to be out.
It's out in April. You can see it on the Ohio State website and the Amazon website. It's kind of out and up there. You can look at the really cool cover that I did not design. But it should be out. It should be out in weeks now, which is so
cool. That's really exciting.
The lab has a website. If you just Google Confluence Lab Idaho, you'll come up with the lab website. And that's a really great place to learn more about what we're doing. You know, the lab has Instagram and Facebook accounts and stuff like that. So you can check us out there.
And thank you all for listening to this episode of the Narrative for Social Justice podcast. If you would like to contact us, please feel free to send us an email at narrative4sj@gmail.com. That's the number 4. You can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is @narrative4sj. And we're also on Facebook. Our Facebook group is called Narrative for Social Justice.